Hello, I'm Brian.
And I'm Caroline.
I'm Claire.
And this is the Computer Weekly
Downtime Upload
Podcast.
Welcome back to the podcast and a very warm welcome if you're a first-time listener. We're very pleased to have with us for this episode our security editor, Alex Croxton. Hello, Alex.
Hi there.
Welcome back. We're pleased, but also somewhat somber because Alex, as our security correspondent, security editor, is back on the podcast to talk about the situation in and connected with Ukraine. And because this is the most serious subject that there is, this podcast is just about that topic. As well as the cyber war aspect, we'll also discuss the IT industry's response to Putin's invasion of Ukraine. Started on the 24th of February, I think it's day 15 or 16, as we record this. Now, Caroline, you're going to kick us off today, so can I invite you to get the ball rolling with Alex, please?
When you were last on the podcast several weeks ago, Russia was making its presence keenly felt at the Ukraine border ahead of its invasion. At that point, though, various Ukrainian websites, government websites, and banking websites had found themselves already under attack from Russian hackers. And you mentioned that there was a possibility that Russia was gearing up for a full-scale cyber war against the Ukraine. So I've read a few of your pieces you've written recently since the last time you were on, with quite a lot of interest about how Ukraine is sort of responding to that now. And there's one actually in particular that really caught my eye, which is something about what you termed these cyber irregulars or volunteer hackers have responded to Ukraine's call to create an IT army to soup up the country's cyber defences and also, I guess, facilitate sort of retaliatory attacks against Russia. So on the face of it, it sounds like a worthy cause to get behind, you know, real sort of David and Goliath stuff. But as the people you spoke to in this story alluded to, there are risks involved for people who sign up as volunteer hackers to, you know, participate in this kind of direct action, isn't there?
Yeah, I can't stress enough, don't hack the Russian government.
Yeah.
Well, please don't. Just it's not worth it for so many reasons. I was going to say, I don't recall if I was last on the week before everything kicked off or the week before that. What I think it is worth pointing out is that the sort of anticipated cyber war against Western targets that people were warning about, the US CISA Director Jen Easterly said in her warning, shields up, hasn't materialized. Mm. There haven't been attacks on critical infrastructure outside Ukraine, which has surprised some people, not surprised others. The cyber irregulars, cyber hacktivists, the IT army or that you allude to, this was for those coming to this for the first time, there may be some people, was actually an initiative of Ukraine's government, which put out a call on Twitter for hacktivists and cybersecurity pros to rally to its banner. They've been organizing on Telegram, which is the encrypted messaging channel, and they've been with some success and some failures conducting distributed denial of service attacks, mostly against targets in Russia. Some of the other attacks that have hit the headlines have been against TV networks and state and so on, which have been had their broadcast feeds hacked to show footage from the war. Alongside this, there are also groups affiliated with the Anonymous collective, and Anonymous, as I'm sure you know, is pretty hard to define exactly who they are, and I think Anonymous would agree with me that they don't particularly care to be defined as anything. And it's these guys that are making a lot of noise on social media. Last night, a story did the rounds that some of them had hacked and stolen Kaspersky's source code, which turned out, as far as we know at this point, not to be the case. But let's talk about, I guess, some of the reasons why it's a bad idea to get involved in this sort of thing. I'm going to go to Brian Higgins at Comparatech, who spoke to us for this report who explains very succinctly why taking direct action against Russian targets is something to be best avoided. You don't have the intelligence, said Brian. It could be a friendly target or a covert asset. You don't have the field knowledge. You could be attacking the same target as those you're trying to help. You don't know the infrastructure or network. You could be impacting civilians, aid agencies, or even your own side supply chain. Whatever the motivation, direct action that you take is not guaranteed to have its desired effect. A professional military campaign, and we can argue till the cows come home about professionalism in the military, of course, but such campaigns are based on intelligence to guarantee the best results and ultimately the best chance of success. These targets are researched and chosen with specific goals in mind, and as Higgins pointed out, uncoordinated cyber attacks just throw a spanner into the works of what Ukraine's army, Ukraine's professional army, is trying to do. It's also very hard to predict the consequences of these things, as a lot of people who I spoke to stressed. There's no strategy, there's no coordination. And ultimately, it's also a slippery slope. We also spoke to KnowBefore's Roger Grimes, who rejoices in the title of data-driven defense evangelist. And he said, look, if you rob a bank, you're a bank robber. It doesn't matter what you intended to do. Today, you might be hacking a Russian TV station or a government agency, but tomorrow you're attacking BT's billing department because you didn't like the charges on your phone bill. You don't hack someone without their permission if you're an ethical hacker. So I'm sure our listeners will not be considering such action, but yeah, all I can say is just do not do this.
Yeah, because I guess when you're reading a story like that, you do kind of have to mind that there might be people who are like, oh, you know, I'm a bit of a have a go here, I'll get involved in this. And then the fear is that there'll be a triumph, it'll be a triumph of enthusiasm over, like as you alluded to, sort of actually knowing what you're really getting into and what, you know, the ripple effects of what you're doing is and stuff like that as well.
Yeah, exactly. It's just the risks inherent in direct action are just too great, at least as far as I'm concerned. So, I could not in good conscience say hack anything. But,
yeah,
you know, obviously there are ethical hackers out there. We speak to them frequently. They're a lovely bunch of people. Many of them are reformed cyber criminals, and they do, you know, good official work on the books, making sure that the, you know, organizations have appropriate cybersecurity protections in place. It's a very valid career choice. Not all hackers are bad, but the security community being what it is, having a lot of people who come from sort of both sides of the same coin, the lines between ethical hacking and criminal hacking are blurry at the best of times and can be crossed very easily if one is not paying attention.
And on a related note as well, another story of yours I picked up on was around, I guess I'm probably, this is very simplistic in terms of how I'm framing it, but you know, the Ukraine's status as a target and a victim of cyber attacks has seen it sort of sworn in as a contributor to NATO's Cooperative Cyber Defense Center of Excellence. And so while Ukraine is not a formal member of NATO itself, its experience expertise in this area are viewed as a valuable source of information for this part of NATO or this arm of it, so its members can protect themselves. To me, that seems like a sort of positive move for all involved. Is that the right way of looking at this, or are there other implications I'm sort of missing on that?
The worrying implication, I guess, which I would bring up, and you know, I don't speak with a, you know, with a military background, or God forbid anything like that, would be that even being associated with a NATO body potentially gives Russia reason to or motivation to do bad things. But yeah, in general, the CCD COE. Again, for those new to this, this was a NATO initiative spearheaded by the Estonians. In fact, it's headquartered in Tallinn in Estonia, was set up following cyber attacks on that country that were attributed to Russia. It's a number of NATO states and several observers, countries like Switzerland and Finland are both involved, despite not being NATO members, now Ukraine as well. So they do good work. And Caroline, you're right to say that Ukraine brings direct experience of cyber attacks originating either from the Kremlin or from bodies backed by the Kremlin. And they've been facing this sort of threat for a long time. Let's not forget that they're electrical infrastructure grid was hacked in 2015. NotPetya attacks 2 years later were targeted at Ukraine, clearly subsequently hit worldwide organizations as well. So there's a wealth of experience in the country that could, I think, prove valuable. It's a good step. Questions over the timing, but probably on balance the right time for Ukraine to join such an organization. If they were going to join, then, you know, they'd want to do it now.
Thank you for that, Alex. It's really, really interesting to get all that kind of context and subtlety around that you provide. I mean, you write very well about everything, but we're very fortunate to have you writing on this topic at this time. I mean, that's the cyber war side of this tragic, indeed horrific situation. But for us as IT journalists, has also been the response of the IT industry itself and also, I suppose, the corporate user side of the IT industry. The story here goes back to, similar to what Alex was saying earlier, a call for help on Twitter from Mikhailo Fedorov, who's the Vice Prime Minister of Ukraine and also the Minister of Digital Transformation. And one of his specific appeals was to Christian Klein, the CEO of SAP, and to Larry Ellison and Safra Katz over at Oracle. And he made that appeal for help to them on the 2nd of March. They responded positively. SAP CEO Christian Klein put out a statement on the same day entitled Standing in Solidarity, generally saying they support the various government sanctions against the Russian Federation, announcing humanitarian aids, also opening up SAP offices for refugees to stay in, various other things. And on the business side, stopping operations in Russia. And on the 9th of March, he updated his statement, Christian Klein, to suspend SAP sales in Russia. Just very briefly about SAP in Russia, represents roughly 2% of SAP's revenue. And kind of looking around the kind of business boycott, if you like, of Russia, that 2% figure seems to be fairly uniform. So in 2018, that was about 470 million euros. So you say not a lot, but still quite significant. I figured out if it's the same percentage then in 2021, it was round about 560 million euros. Now, Russia's economy is very strong, as is well known, in oil and gas and banking as well, to be fair. There's a lot of retail in a lot of brands kind of active in Russia. In other words, it's good territory for SAP and for other kind of big enterprise software companies. SAP specifically was a sponsor of Zenit St. Petersburg. It's a famous Russian football team, along with Gazprom, which I think is the main sponsor. Now, like I said, 2% doesn't sound like a lot, but it is a significant relationship. So in 2018, they had 1,600 customers and 1,300 employees in Russia. Oracle also suspended operations similarly in response to that call from Mr. Fedorov. Now, in terms of the IT industry more broadly, some of our Tech Target colleagues have put together a very useful article, I think, the title of which is Russian Sanctions Prompt Tech to Stop Sales and Curb Services. We'll include a link to that in the article that goes with the podcast. It contains a very useful table listing all the IT companies who, how to put this, are limiting their business activities in Russia in various ways. And again, this is in response to the original plea from Mr. Fedorov. That table goes through from Apple and Amazon, through Google, IBM to VMware, Meta is also mentioned, etc. I think there was around 32, 33 by the 4th of March. But that article also, and this is quite a good way into the story, it contains a video interview between the main author of this piece, Mackenzie Holland, and our other colleague, Nicole Lukowski. And it's a good way in that interview. It's quite a kind of quick way to access that story. I should say that Pat Thibodeau and Jim O'Donnell were the other main journalists on that story. Like I said, we'll put a link to that. But what I wanted to say was Mackenzie makes a really good point about unity across the IT industry. I mean, yes, Russia spends about 10% of what China spends on IT. And it tends to be around 2% of revenue of these tech companies by and large. And the response to the details is less maybe uniform than it should be. Some people are doing different things. And it'll probably become more uniform in future. But she says that the unity of the industry is very impressive, and it's hard not to agree with that. It is quite an impressive reaction. Oh, and Microsoft is also on the list, and it reacted about the same time as SAP and Oracle, didn't it, Alex? I know you picked that one up.
Yes, 4th of March, I think Microsoft put out quite a strongly worded statement from Brad Smith, who's a president and vice chair, unprovoked and unlawful, he said the invasion was. I thought it was interesting that SAP put out quite a lengthy statement, but Oracle just dropped a single tweet and then ran. It was very much a mic drop, a mic drop moment in IT news. Just no comment, just the tweet, and we're out.
I mean, they are like all these American companies. They have joined an effective, you know, boycott. I think with SAP, because it's a German company, because it's the kind of one of the flagship companies of the German economy, German nation, you know, they're much more tuned into Russia. You know, they're much more connected. It's not as far away geographically and things like that. So that might be part of the reason that I'm speculating, completely speculating there.
And well, on that point of speculation, I think the Search CIO story you were talking about mentioned as well that there is a degree of uncertainty about how some of these product and tech product and service bans will, how effective they'll be in terms of destabilizing Russia, you know, because there is potential for Russia to, well, already it's got capacity to maybe build out replacement services. Obviously, that will take time, but it's kind of like, okay, so I think one of the examples shared in there is around Apple Pay, and that's the fact that that's been pulled in Russia means that there's been long queues outside train stations and stuff. Obviously, yeah, People have still got cash, so they can pay that way. So yeah, while it's inconveniencing, it's not, you know, it's difficult to tell at this stage just how far-reaching these consequences will be.
I think up to recently, sanctions against Russia for various reasons had not been terribly effective. So, but there's certainly a feeling now that they're going to be, that this round will be more so, just because it's so.
Mm.
I remember listening to a thing about a year ago. A report was talking about the cheese industry, and the French had slapped tariffs on. Or some kind of tit-for-tat tariff war going on between Russia and France at the time, with the result that French cheese became harder to get in Russia. But the result for the Russians was that they were developing quite a decent cheese industry of their own. So they have a certain amount of self-sufficiency, which I think is why they've been able to shrug off Western sanctions in the past, because it didn't matter.
Mm. One area they did flag, though, is potentially quite problematic, is around, which is something we're all affected by anyway, but it'll be exacerbated in Russia because of the sanctions, is around the semiconductor shortages. Mm. So, like, speaking, but that has had wide-ranging effects. Like, as I said, things are so widely used in sort of laptops and mobile devices, but also military equipment. You know, with Russia being increasingly cut off, it's sort of saying, you know, supplies of semiconductors into Russia are going to be really, really badly affected. So that may have the biggest maybe effect of most of these things so far from a tech perspective, but as ever, you have to wait and see.
I mean, there might be a parallel with China, which does seem to have its own services, doesn't it? I forget the name of them. There's WeChat and mm-hmm. search engine and that kind of thing. Our colleague Cliff Sarin's written a very good blog post, a moving blog post that's also the leader in the current issue of the issue that we're signing off of the Computer Weekly e-zine, and yeah, he talks about the kind of the global IT community support that there has been for the people of Ukraine. I think that's something that you noted from made a note of, didn't you, Claire? Or do you want to jump in on that one? The kind of global village idea, helping each other and stuff.
I suppose one of the things in Cliff's blog that really stood out to me was he notes, in Ukraine, data and communications industry engineers have been working from bomb shelters and running out to repair internet cables when bombing stops in Ukraine's border cities. And I think that definitely speaks to how powerful technology is in connecting people. You know, if you think back to a time where it wouldn't have been so easy to contact people outside of the country or reach others, sometimes the situation could seem a lot worse, if that makes sense. You can't communicate what's happening, you can't inform people outside of the country what's happening. Yeah. Inside the borders, harder to get people on board to sort of rally around you. So technology has been helpful in that way as well, I think, in just sort of keeping people connected and in that camaraderie community that it's sort of created as well, you know. So I thought that was quite an important part of Cliff's piece. But this is an outsider's perspective from me. I mean, my areas of coverage aren't quite as technical as other people, so I've been, you know, just sort of like reading, trying to pick up on what everything means. It seems a lot of companies have had to go into sort of like a second wave of crisis management, if that makes sense. You know, like you had the pandemic, everybody has to make some tough choices and look on almost on sort of like their emergency situation provisions. What do we do? How do we, you know, like deal with the current situation? And then one lets up, then another thing just comes straight on in.
But yeah, that point you made there, Claire, about, you know, now being able to kind of communicate with the outside, where maybe in previously that would have been less possible, mm-hmm. or impossible. One of the hugely impressive things about this terrible situation is Zelensky and the way that he's used social media and all sorts of ways of communicating. He's in both Ukrainian and in Russian and in English, you know, his videos and just all the stuff that he's been doing. And he very much seems on the side of the modern, the future, the progressive. I mean, I'm not the first person to have said this. Lots and lots of people are making this point. And he's such a charismatic kind of guy as well, you know, former comedian. He's a very good communicator. So I think that's been hugely impressive, the way they've been able to use social media to, there's a phrase, isn't there, Alex, in the security community about, what is it, the narrative, the information warfare narrative or something like that. But they're very much on top of that and very much.
They've, the phrase that a lot of people like to use is seize the memes of production. Yeah, I thought you might like that. But yeah, it's true that Ukraine has managed to control the information narrative in a way that I don't think anybody was expecting. I actually wrote a bit about this myself last week, with a big spike that was seen in use of Telegram, which is an encrypted messaging platform that's being used by both sides. But it's being used in particular to kind of inform opposition to the war within Russia. And I think it's important to note that the Russian people are not, their government in many ways are victims in this just as much as the Ukrainian people. They're just being led by bad people. So the fact that it's being used to coordinate sort of, not just the IT hacktivist army that we spoke about earlier, but just, you know, spreading the word that this isn't a war of liberation, as Putin is trying to term it, that it's a war of aggression, is valuable. And yeah, the Ukrainians have done great work in dominating that side of the narrative.
Yeah, and you make an absolutely brilliant point about the opposition within Russia and the uses that it is making and will make in the future. Well, look, it goes without saying this. I mean, this is a very difficult situation for anyone to talk about. And we are, you know, we are not geopolitical journalists, we're IT journalists, and we'll continue to write on the kind of IT aspects of the crisis. And hopefully that will be helpful somehow, somewhere. You can, as usual, read the stories that we've discussed in the episode or just touched on here via the article that goes with the podcast, and listen to the podcast itself on computerweekly.com. And you can subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Amazon Music. I think that's all we've got time for this time around. Thank you ever so much again, Alex, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me again. It's a tricky topic, and I echo your sentiment that it's one that's hard to speak about.
And thank you, as always and ever, to Caroline.
You're welcome.
And thank you to Claire.
Anytime.
And thank you to your listener very much for listening. Okay, until next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.